We're back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell has just led me right to where I want to be with Dr. Cornel West. I find it remarkable to sit and listen to you as I do when I am reading you, and you have a big opus of work to read. You had to go back and do the work to understand where we came from. You are so graceful in the ways that you can call forth the strains, many of them directly out of the white European, all the way back to Greece, the very clearly Western intellectual tradition. And then, having done all that work, and you say you can't really get started till you're 25 years into your work, then you come forth in the process of doing that and say, and I have a job as a public intellectual. And as Bill says, intellectual to most people says, okay, I'm going to sit on my hands and think.
Well, and it's also the difference, I think, for most people, the difference between theory and practice.
Mm-hmm.
And my clear sense is that you are, for all you've done a tremendous amount of theoretical work, that there is a practice in here. And it is that practice,
almost
it seems.
Almost in the Buddhist sense of a practice.
Yeah, it is in that sense, I think, that the conversations are, and the energy, the drivers, are there to drive us forward into a better place. How do you make that connection from the theory, which is, you know, what your work looks like?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people would probably dismiss you as, you know, well, that's real cute, that's interesting. Yeah, but meanwhile, in the real world, you know, we got budgets and
right.
we got, you know, right. we got to run the world and that's something, right. something, something. So thank you very much. That was a nice speech. You know, let us know the next time you're back in town.
But the very things that you're talking about in your speech and in your writings will come back and haunt the very folk who are the busybodies of the present, because those realities.
The busybodies of the present?
Right.
Is that what you said?
Right.
How wonderful.
Sometimes a little bit too short-sighted, but understandably so, because they got to deal with short-term situations. But there's long-term context, you see. And one of the roles of intellectuals is to try to tell some of the fallible truths about the larger context that are inescapable, even if they don't directly impinge upon us at the present. And to do that in such a way that it exposes, you know, certain levels of mendacity and hypocrisy that we all have to wrestle with in our daily lives. And here I really appeal to John Dewey, of course, probably the greatest American public intellectual ever, and also the leading figure in American pragmatism, which is a tradition misunderstood by most people in America and around the world. It's not opportunism. It's not practicalism. It's not getting over. It's not trying to somehow beat the other person. American pragmatism is a rich philosophical tradition that tries to deal with relational theory and praxis and acknowledges intellectual work as a form of practice. Still has critical distance, but is always engaging the problems of human beings, be it in scientific communities, political communities, and so forth. And so I think your question about theory versus practice has much to do with my own depths to John Dewey, who is also a radical Democrat politically, and deeply wedded to Walt Whitman in regard to these issues of existential democracy.
Well, and he got in there and rolled up his sleeves and got dirty.
All the time. You know, the wonderful phrase, Ezra Pound says that Walt Whitman is an exceeding good stench, but he is America. And by
did
that,
you say stench?
Stench. It just stank, you know.
And, won't leave you alone.
It just won't leave you alone, and he stinks. He's dealing with the dirt of life. He's dealing with everyday life. He's dealing with the streets, and William James talks about this in his essays on pragmatism. We're going to take philosophy to the streets. That's not the Doobie Brothers speaking. That's William James. We're taking it to the streets. What do you mean by that? Well, philosopher in an ivory tower, platonic quest for purity, emerging out of the cave. Only philosopher kings emerge out of the cave. And pragmatists say, actually, we're taking philosophy right where Socrates took it, to the streets, to the marketplace, to the contexts that have been overlooked by those in the ivory tower. But we do it in such a way that we still have a critical perspective. And that's where they still have a connection with Platonic dialogues and so forth that are very much about critical perspective.
Well, and both of those describe what you do.
Well, at least I aspire to that. I fall short, but that's part of the comic.
Part of the challenge And you've been very critical of it, is the removal of thought, in particular philosophy, but thought in general, into the academic environment, and the presumed requirement that the academy has to certify any thought in order to demonstrate that it is relevant, that it is an important thought. Not to say that it's even relevant, but that it, you know, it is a thought worth thinking. And that Absolutely. Would seem to be particularly dangerous, and dangerous particularly to the extent that the academy is separated out from the rest of the world, that people are not, as you, out all day, every day, mixing it up, elbow to...
Because you become unicontextual, you see. I mean, democracy...
Contextual.
Mm-hmm. Democracy is about multi-contextual. You have to be able to move from one context to the other. The problem of the academy, and William James saw this well in his critique of professionalism, is that professionalism easily becomes a form of respectability. All forms of respectability are species of blindness. And all forms of respectability are predicated on mechanisms of exclusivity, of exclusion. So you're fearful of the challenge from the outside. Now, I believe that it is very important to take the academy seriously, but it's not necessarily a matter of going through the academy. The question is whether the best of the academy goes through you. See, James Baldwin didn't go to college, but the college went through him. Because what the college is supposed to offer, the great text, the wrestling, the conversations, the questions, the terrifying queries, he's wrestling with.
That's almost a definition of a substantial part of what the academy should be doing.
Absolutely. And at its best, you know, there's still some good people around, the Edward Zaids and Gary Wills and Barbara Ehrenreichs, who engage the academy but also keep the public intellectual and the serious intellectual work going.
You used a word, a phrase, multicontextualism, that is seems to me to be a clarification of a very confused term in popular usage, which is multiculturalism.
That's right.
And that if Absolutely. We just drop that word and
what,
look
drop
at
multicultural?
Yeah, because it's confusing. One, it's been overused. It's been used as a hammer, and depending on who's using it, it's a different shaped hammer. But multicontextualism. Is the
it's hard
point,
to say.
Is the point. Well, MC. not to be confused with Hammer.
Culture. What do you think?
But isn't that a lot Absolutely. Of the challenge? Because we've gotten all wrapped up in this multiculturalism. You know, is it or is it, does it or doesn't? Absolutely. Who's on top? Who's
And the truth of the matter is most of the discussion about multiculturalism is really about race. If all right. black, brown, red, yellow people disappeared in America tomorrow, you got all white brothers and sisters, America would still be multicultural. But there'd be no debate about multiculturalism because you got this rich cultural diversity from Europe in America. Scandinavians in Minnesota, Scots in Georgia, Irish in Boston. But whiteness becomes a construct that makes that look homogeneous. So that when we're really talking about multiculturalism, we're talking about these very different contexts in which a variety of different cultures and subcultures are bouncing up against one another, interacting, interpenetrating, and so forth.
Well, and it would seem that perspective would at least eliminate some of the stereotyping that goes on, because instantly it gets reduced to black and white, yes. even implicitly, and then you assume that everybody that is black is of a certain character and behavior and has a certain sets of belief, and everyone that's white is on the other side of that. Absolutely. And I guess
that's
as much
even before you talk about gender.
Well, and yeah. but you get into the same kinds of things, and it would seem that the point is the context, and to be able to be adept to function with some elegance.
To swing
in that deep sense, and it also tends toward the historical amnesia of so much of America. So when we talk about identity politics, no one person has one identity at all. You got a family identity, you got a religious or non-religious identity, you got an ideological political identity, you've got an intellectual identity, you've got a regional identity. So all those things, gender identity, sexual orientational identity, we are all of those things. But oftentimes people think identity politics, they just think race and gender.
Walter Truitt Anderson makes a real point about this being essential to what we, the misunderstood word, the postmodern. Mm-hmm. The modern being when great ideologies ruled, and the postmodern being later, when we begin to see things from a variety, like a diamond with many facets, that seems right. to be essentially postmodern. Do I get that right?
Yes, because I mean, this issue of postmodern is a very complex one, though, because we don't know whether it's a term that designates a certain historical period, whether it relates to a certain set of styles or sensibilities, or whether it relates to certain ways and modes of thinking. You think of Jacques Derrida as postmodern philosopher, but you can get Nietzsche, who is very late modern, prefiguring much of what's in Derrida's work. We think of postmodern in terms of market-driven culture, but consumerism takes off in the latter part of the 19th century, as we know, both in America and Paris and other places. Baudelaire and others were talking about this. There's a whole host of ways of talking about this. What I like about postmodernity is that it makes us suspicious of forms of dogmatism and orthodoxy, but we don't need a term like postmodern to make us suspicious. We ought to be suspicious in the first place. Absolutely, right? Just suspicion will do. I think Socrates was suspicious. Pascal, in many ways, was suspicious. Hume was suspicious in that way. They took skepticism very, very seriously. But our historical moment is different. See, the dominance of America after 1945 in the world makes the world a different place.
And that is a contextual.
And that is a contextual
condition.
Absolutely. And you ask people around the world, in Asia, how does America relate to your anti-colonial struggle in the 40s and 50s? In Africa, now in the 90s, how does America relate to your economy? Disproportionate power, you see.
Short, Bill.
Later, Paula.
We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Stay tuned.